Welcome to Insight, live at noon with a rebroadcast at 7 p.m. California's primary election is less than a month away, which comes with a big decision in the race for Sacramento mayor. Ahead on Insight, we kick off our conversations with the four leading candidates. And up first is former city council member Steve Hansen. Also, she blends social commentary with humor, sarcasm, and a disregard for technology. Fran Lebowitz joins us ahead of her event at the Mondavi Center at UC Davis. Finally, one of the longest-running cast members, from Whose Line Is It Anyway, is making his way to Sacramento. We chat with comedian Greg Proops about his life and career ahead of his performance at the Sophia this weekend. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. That's all coming up today on Insight. First, here's the news. From Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. In less than 4 weeks, a pivotal decision will be made in the primary for the Sacramento mayoral race, a race that can actually be decided on March 5th if a candidate receives 50% plus one of the vote. If that doesn't happen, the top two candidates will move to the general election, and whoever wins will begin serving a four-year term in December. The four candidates on the Sacramento Voter Guide delivered to households are epidemiologist Dr. Flojan Kofer, former city council member Steve Hansen, state assembly member Kevin McCarty, and former state lawmaker Dr. Richard Pan. Over the next four Thursdays, we're going to sit down with the four leading mayoral candidates. Today, former council member Steve Hansen joins us about why he believes he's best to lead the city, as well as his top priorities if elected. Good afternoon.
Hi, Vicki. It's so great to be back on Insight.
Thank you for making the time. I can only imagine how busy the weeks are leading up to the primary. You're really no stranger when it comes to Sacramento government. You were a city council member from 2012 to 2020. You know the inner workings as well as the challenges that face the city. Was it a natural reflex to run for mayor?
So it's funny. I reflected for a long time. When I left office, I didn't intend to ever run again. But as a poor kid whose parents divorced when I was young, we moved around a lot. My mom had abusive boyfriends. We were in domestic violence shelters, ate at soup kitchens, government cheese. I've always felt so extremely lucky to have made it to the other side of those experiences that I've always felt an obligation to give back. And in 2022, it's not last year anymore because we're in 24, but I worked downtown. I run a small business. I lived on the grid for 22 years. We moved to South Natomas last year. It got so bad, I decided rather than just getting angry, I would do something because I thought I could make a difference. And so that's why I ran.
When you say it, what is that specific it when it got so bad?
You know, some unhoused people burned a duplex and a fourplex down that was across from us. Our daycare at 12th and D, surrounded by camps and fires and syringes, people jumping the fences. But our employees, even at my business, were being harassed. I saw so many things, and it just felt like there wasn't the attentiveness to taking care of that renaissance that I was so proud of working on during my time on council. The stuff I was really proud of was falling apart, and I wanted to do something to put us back on track. Sacramento's a great American city, and I think we deserve an active and attentive local government, and that's what I want to do.
And I know that local governments, including the city of Sacramento, as well as the county of Sacramento, the state as a whole, has devoted unprecedented resources to this crisis. I mean, if you become mayor, what can you do within your first year where residents will feel a tangible difference in the right direction?
Yeah, well, I mean, homelessness is the number one issue, and homelessness is one word for 1,000 problems. So there's no magic wand that's going to fix it. The county, I think, has really turned a corner in how it's approaching things. Their stay sites have been, I think, relatively successful and are a model that the city should be emulating for how we can approach it. But in the roles of government, the city is not funded to do social services, mental health. That's the county's role. So that's part of why we need to partner. But a mayor's job is to keep the city safe, to make sure it's clean, and to help our small businesses and economic situation thrive. And right now, it feels like we're losing so many of our small businesses. We're losing people who are opting to move out of town to the suburbs. Even for me, people kind of jaw dropped when I told them I moved to South Natomas, because I am such a part of the legacy of the grid. And so I think we just need to get back to work. This is a city where we have to work for a living, and that hard work is good luck. So just getting back to the basics, I think, is a key part of making it better.
When it comes to the county, and you see that they've rounded a corner, I mean, as you know, the city and the county need to work in tandem on this, and something that they've actually agreed to on paper following the passing of Measure O. But there is tension. There have been lawsuits between the DA's office and the city. You would inherit this. What do you do?
Well, I think a lot of this has been because, whether it's the city or other governments, there's been things that have been adopted, but the voters don't see the outcome. So these investments aren't producing tangible results. So really using an evidence-based approach, like you would in healthcare or other places, to step back, see what's working, what's not working. We know we need to build a lot more housing at all levels of affordability. We know that Care Accord is finally here, and that can make a big difference. This is why I'm supporting Prop 1, which is the reform to Prop 63, the millionaire's tax, so we can build more psychiatric beds, which we know we have a terrible shortage of. But also, as we look at getting people with severe mental illness off the streets, we have to partner with our healthcare systems, our community clinics, and that whole ecosystem. So the city has a role to play, and my job is to convene as mayor those partners and see where we can play our best role. But public safety is really important. You know, our staffing in the police department's lower than during the Great Recession. We have 100 vacancies, and those are funded vacancies, but right now we use overtime, which is a lot more expensive, and we're burning people out. So we're losing good officers to other jurisdictions. People are retiring early. And I think getting us back to a place where neighborhood safety is improved, response times are improved, is a key piece of the overall feelings of what direction Sacramento is on.
Following a debate that was held on KVIE, you addressed this about wanting to fill the vacancy of 100 police officers within your first year as mayor. Why is this one of your top priorities?
Well, right now, what I hear the most from people is they don't really feel safe in their neighborhoods or where they work or where they shop. Some of that's, you know, the retail theft going on. Some of that's just they see people doing drugs or hurting other people. And even when we went to Santa Parade in December with my two kids, I have a 4 and a 6-year-old, it was very bad downtown. The conditions in not just downtown, but in other neighborhoods throughout the city, people are really upset. And so law enforcement isn't a be-all, end-all. We have to pair it with social services and the other outreach work we've done. But we definitely know that we need, at least on a per capita basis, a lot more officers than we have if we want people to feel safe who've been victims of crime.
And funding for the police department, I mean, it has been controversial, especially in recent years. You can just go to city council meetings. There are passionate public comment from residents who argue that it isn't the best investment to serve the communities that are most impacted by crime. What is your response to that?
Well, the city, like any city, our primary duty is police, fire, parks, and public works. And so we know there are bad people out there. We're not going to get rid of our police department. I disagree with one of my opponents who wants to defund the police department to the tune of $70 million, which was just in the B last week. And I also believe that most of the region, most of our city, wants good officers. They want to be held accountable if they do something wrong. But they see the police as a positive if we continue our progress in making sure that they're well-trained and well-prepared. Because, you know, even the shooting at Grant High School, I think it was about 2 weeks ago now, the first responders there, Twin Rivers Unified School Police and Sac City PD, it gave the community comfort that something was being done quickly. And if you make a call to 911 and no one shows up, or it's going to be a 25-30 minute wait, that's a really bad thing for a city like ours. And that's not what the public wants. Mm.
The city also has a unique dynamic, being that it is a weak mayor city versus a strong mayor city. And Mayor Steinberg has expressed his frustrations with this. Not being able to get some of the items that he was passionate about across the finish line, because effectively you're just one vote. And you've been a council member during both Mayor Steinberg's term as well as his predecessor. How will you collaborate and compromise with a different city council that is now there for effective change?
Well, my record on the city council, I was able to get things done that most people now take for granted. The Museum of Science and Curiosity was a very difficult lift. We got votes for that. Now, that's a good thing, but building bike lanes, building housing, there's a lot of things out there that were really hard and were not necessarily going to happen. But as a poor kid, I was never given anything. And so I've always had to work with other people to build coalitions, to build support. And because of that, I'm not afraid to compromise, to work together, to get the city the progress it deserves. Look, to those who are given much, much is expected. But here in our city, we have an egalitarian city. We need to work together. We're supposed to work together. There's no demigod who can point at somebody and say, if you don't do this, I'm going to punish you. And that's one of the problems with being a capital city, especially in California, where we have these megalopolises like LA or the Bay Area. They dominate the culture. And Sacramento is treated in a lot of ways like a second-class city in the psychology of the state. When people want to complain about the legislature, they say, Sacramento did this to us. Sacramento did this to us. Well, the city isn't doing it. It's the state capital. So we've got to reshape how we see ourselves and claim our opportunity, fight for what we need, and make sure that everybody knows that we're all hands on deck. We're going to work as a team and we're going to get this stuff done.
Given that you were in city council during Mayor Steinberg's first term, and prior to that, it was with former Mayor Kevin Johnson, how do you think Steinberg has led the city?
You know, I've known Daryl for 22 years and we've worked together well. He and I don't always agree, and we've did some good things together. Our work on the arts, the convention center, the theater renovations, some of the housing projects. I would handle the public safety and homelessness issues differently, but I also believe that you can't fault Daryl for trying, but I also think that former legislators are not always an easy fit for local government because when you're in a body of 120, it's just different. How you do business is different. And I don't fault Daryl for not trying. He tried very hard, but I also think that there's a humility that I bring to this, having been a former council member. And you know, losing a race, just like losing my mom last year, or these other things, these terrible things that might otherwise want you to curl up in a ball and never leave the house again, you get back up, you dust yourself off, and you go again, because ultimately that resilience is part of how we move the city forward. Because if somebody just says no once and you give up, then you're never going to have anything. But we're a city that, like I said, has to work for a living.
The mayor has yet to endorse any of the candidates. Is that something that interests you, his endorsement?
You know, I respect the mayor. I think he's talked to all the candidates and he'll do what he thinks is right. I'm focused on my campaign, on talking to neighbors. We had a meet and greet in Southland Park last night. We had a forum in Curtis Park the night before, put on by neighborhood associations. And I'll go and talk to anybody, but it's the voters that are going to make this decision, not an endorsement, not donors. The voters have to choose who they want to lead us into our future. This is our city. It's our future. And we have to fight for it, because I don't believe anybody should be on the sidelines when it comes to making sure Sacramento is the best it can be.
You mentioned having to overcome and navigate losses or things not going the way that you wanted. When you lost your election for re-election for city council, that position is now held by council member Katie Valenzuela. What did you learn from that experience? And are you applying any of those lessons to this campaign?
Well, you know, it's funny because a lot of my friends are wondering, you have such a good life. You got two beautiful boys. Like, why are you doing this? It's because I love the city and I will never give up on Sacramento. And, you know, people lose things that are really much more significant than an election. And taking my dad off life support when I was 25, lose it. My brother went to live in a group home when I was 7. I haven't lived with him since. He aged out of that group home and still lives with the family who ran it. So I look at that as just a piece of my story, and it's not a defining characteristic, but I am tenacious. I am hardworking. I don't give up, but I try to work together and build the kind of community that we deserve. So I'm not perfect. Nobody running for office is, but I will give Sacramento my all. And I think that is exactly what we need at this juncture to put the city back on track.
If you are elected mayor, I know you're well aware of this. The city is facing an estimated $50 million budget deficit for the upcoming fiscal year, and it likely very possibly may not be the only year to prepare for financial challenges. How will you prioritize funding city services?
Well, we have to protect core services. When I joined the council in 2012, we didn't know it was the tail end of the Great Recession, and we'd put in place some very important fiscal policies, creating an economic uncertainty reserve. I passed a policy to make sure it was 10% of the general fund. They have a choice this year of whether they tap that or not. The truth is that during the Great Recession, we had a revenue problem. But right now, this deficit is a spending problem. And we have to make sure that while we protect our core services, which are the purposes of a city, police, fire, and park services, that we also position ourselves for the inevitable transition our city is going through as a government center to something much more interesting and creative, which is a destination, not only for our region, but for people from all over, festivals, concerts, arts, food. Obviously, we call ourselves the Farm to Fork Capital, but we're such a wonderful place to visit that, you know, there's a blessing in disguise in this transition that if we grab it, I think we can build a much more resilient economy. But the budget deficit is going to be difficult, but we have to be smart and strategic about how we shave off costs, but also reposition ourselves to make strategic investments to grow the economy.
We only have 30 seconds left. I'm curious, because you were Sacramento's first openly gay council member, and if elected, you would become the first out gay mayor of Sacramento. Is that more than a headline or a city milestone to you?
So I'm very proud of the work I've done. You know, there are a lot of people out there who really see it as inspiring that we're breaking those barriers. I'm just really focused on the idea that we need our city to be clean, safe, that we need people to be housed. But for my family, for my community, it is a point of pride. And I'm really happy that as mayor, I can make sure that everybody feels welcome in the city of Sacramento, that we're not only inclusive and open when it comes to LGBTQ issues, but our Afghan community, our Persian community, our South Asian community, our Latino community, who felt under attack just like my community, know that this is a safe, welcoming place where they can be and do whatever they are called to do.
Steve, thank you for the time.
Thanks, Vicki.
That is Sacramento mayoral candidate Steve Hansen, who was also a former city council member. And to note, Steve Hansen did join Cap Radio's governing board back in 2021 after he left the council. He resigned from the board in May of last year prior to launching his mayoral campaign. And as I mentioned, this month we're going to be sitting down with the four leading candidates for mayor next Thursday. We'll be joined by epidemiologist Dr. Flojan Kofer. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. Fran Lebowitz. Since the 1970s, she has been captivating audiences with her blend of humor and unfiltered take on culture, politics, and her frustrations of modern life. She is, of course, an accomplished writer. And tomorrow, you can catch an evening with Fran Lebowitz at the Mondavi Center at UC Davis. Setting up our conversation with Lebowitz yesterday was pretty unique. We had to call her hotel exactly at 3 p.m., ask for her room, and be connected by phone. And you will notice the audio quality harkens to another time. She's never been a fan of technology, doesn't even have a cell phone or an email, but you will quickly learn it doesn't mask her iconic way of whipping out opinions without a genuine care if others agree. All right, Fran. Well, thank you for joining Insight. Ahead of your performance or event, rather, at the Mondavi Center, this is a return for you. You were at the Mondavi Center at UC Davis back in 2022, 2 years ago, and UC Davis described you as bringing a little bit of New York City to Yolo County. Do you feel like being a New Yorker is always with you wherever you go?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I can tell how much I hate being out of New York.
By leaving.
Yes, by leaving.
You have spent, obviously, the majority of your life in New York. I know that you were born in New Jersey. If you didn't live in New York City, if that time in your life didn't happen, do you think there's another city in the world that would have fit as well as New York for you?
I really don't think so. I mean, you know, I don't know because I can't look backwards like that, or, you know, which would then require you to look forward from like 50 years ago. I mean, I always wanted to live in New York. I mean, it's true. I grew up in New Jersey, and it was like, I'm trying to remember, like 40 miles away, but it could be 400 miles away. You know, it was so different. But from a time I was a child, we went to New York frequently. I always said, when I grow up, I'm going to live in New York.
Given that you've traveled the world time and time again, I'm curious, what is your impression of this part of California, a college city like Davis?
You know, I know I was there. I actually thought it was last year, so I have no sense of time anymore. But I'm trying to remember which. I went to a couple places. These places are north of San Francisco or south. I don't even know.
East.
Well, see, neither. And I drove from, I mean, when I say I drove, I mean I sat in the back of a car. So these are like, is it possible these places I recall, I haven't, having driven through many farms?
Lots of farms. Yolo County is definitely rural outside of a city like Davis, which is still a small city. I think the population is like 60,000 people. What I also like about...
I thought it was beautiful. I remember thinking it was very beautiful looking, for sure. But I never go to these places think, you know, you should live here, Fran. I never think that.
Given that your events, they include a healthy amount of Q&A from the audience. That sounds like fun. It also sounds like it could take a hard left or go south. What do you enjoy about that kind of spontaneity?
That is my favorite thing. That's my favorite part of it. In fact, that is probably my favorite recreational activity. I love the questions from the audience because you never know what they're going to be. And it's nice to be surprised. And, you know, I can't even guess. You know, people think you can guess from where you are, from the city you're in or the town you're in, but that isn't really always the case. So I really enjoy it. Yeah, you can get, sometimes audiences can be a little raucous. I mean, you know, sometimes you have an engagement that is, for instance, as I did maybe a year or two ago, you know, on a Saturday night in downtown L.A., maybe, you know, that audience is not as serene as you might want it to be. But generally, I find myself to be very entertained by it.
Yeah, I mean, I imagine just since you've been in the public for the majority of your life, I would think questions can become redundant from time to time, and it's just refreshing just to take questions from the audience.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, sometimes you get the same questions. Sometimes, you know, I mean, you often get the same questions, but you often get the same questions from actual journalists. And that is probably because there is a limit to what you could ask me about nuclear physics, but I would be unable to answer you. So people ask questions within your range of maybe not expertise, but at least knowledge.
Mm. What do you make of the fact that the turnout to go see you is still strong? I mean, people spend money. They're willing to spend an evening listening to what you have to say and engage with you.
Well, I am very grateful for this because this is how I'm able to live inside. So I don't really know why. I mean, I've actually been doing this, you know, in various forms since I was 27 and I'm 73. So, you know, I'm happy people are willing to do it. I mean, truthfully, I have been doing this, as I said, for like 50 years. But until that Netflix series came out, I only did it in the United States and Canada. But since that series came out, I do it all over the world. In fact, in a few days when I'm finished in California, I'm going to Australia.
That is definitely a flight. The Netflix series you're talking about, that's the one in like 2021. It was recent.
Yeah. You know what? I think it was 2021. All I know is that it came out during the lockdown worldwide. And so apparently everyone in the world was watching Netflix.
Yeah. Yeah. Streaming definitely took off during that time. When it comes to the lockdown or the pandemic, how was it for you? I think that's kind of an inadequate question, but I'm genuinely curious. How was it for you?
Well, you know, I mean, well, first of all, I wasn't sick. And, you know, New York was really a deadly situation at the beginning. So, you know, you were just happy you weren't in the hospital or dead. So, you know, and you know, for me, you know, personally, it wasn't nearly as bad as it was for other people because, A, I live alone. And a lot of people say to me, oh, you live alone, how horrible. I thought, how could you get through this if there were other people in the apartment? So for me, at least, I was proven correct, and this is the right way to live. So in Europe, for instance, the countries in Europe are allowed to tell people you can't leave your apartment except 1 hour a day. So obviously they can't do that here so far. And so I went out every day. There was no place to go. I didn't go inside anywhere. You know, I walked around the town all the time, mainly to make sure they didn't do things like tear down the library and build condos. You know, just checking up, making sure everything was still there. And, you know, it was, obviously it was weird. I was totally, when I say unprepared for it, I mean, I had never thought in my life once, what if there's a plague? You know, and it turned out that many people had thought that, but these are the people who read or watch science fiction. So this has apparently been on the minds of some people, but not mine. So I was completely, for the first several months, maybe even longer, I really couldn't figure out a way to think about it. I knew how I felt about it. Now, unfortunately, I know how to think about it, you know, and so it wasn't not nearly as bad for me as it was for a lot of people. But also, a lot of people that I knew left New York. They thought, we have to get out of here. I thought, why? You know, so it never even occurred to me. In fact, I did not leave New York City at all for an entire year, and I really wouldn't have noticed it if, you know, there wasn't the plague.
Being able to spend that amount of time alone is easier said than done for a lot of people, clearly not for yourself. Have you always been comfortable just being alone and being with yourself?
I have, I have to tell you. I mean, I've always thought I'm kind of like two people. Like, on the one hand, I'm very sociable. I like to go out. I like parties. I like dinners. On the other hand, when I'm home, I want to be alone. So, you know, what I don't like is domestic life. So I don't have domestic life. I mean, domestic life usually, you know, means there's other people in the house and you have to, like, have meals and stuff with them. So, you know, it didn't bother me in the way that it would bother some people. There are people who hate to be alone, but I'm not one of those people. I really enjoy being alone. I always have, you know, so that, you know, that didn't bother me at all.
And now, I mean, obviously, it's like night and day from that time. I mean, you are, as you said, you're going to be heading to Australia for events as well. I'm curious, you've been doing this, as you say, for like 50 years. When you do these events, like the one at the Mandavi, do you have a creative process or an approach to connecting with people the way that you do? Or is it really just as simple as like showing up and being yourself?
You know what? I prepare not at all. It's perfect for me because I'm very lazy. You know, so to me, it doesn't seem like work. The work, truthfully, is a traveling, which I loathe. You know, so I think like, you know, they pay me to get there. Because being there is something I enjoy a lot. I do not prepare at all. I mean, someone interviews me on stage. Sometimes that person is a journalist. Often they're a journalist or a writer, another kind of writer. And I don't even talk to, I mean, I might say hi backstage, but I sometimes, and very often, especially journalists, they want to talk to you before. They want to, because they want to be prepared. But I would say, ask me whatever you want. You know, if you ask me something I don't want to answer, I won't answer it. And because I also like the surprise of that. So I don't prepare at all. My preparation is coffee.
That's a good preparation. I mean, I think life obviously is like improv. It's yes and you kind of just like dive right into it. You embrace that.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing I like about it, really, I suppose. That's one of the things I like about it. And, you know, but I'm incredibly tired all the time because of traveling and insomnia. And so, you know, my preparation is, you know, I drink like 100 gallons of coffee backstage before I go on.
I think a lot of journalists could relate to that. You know, coffee is probably the first thing I have in the morning. I think some would think that what might help you would be being online, something digital. And I know that you're known for staying away from anything that is digital or online. You don't even have an email address. And we called you on a landline. Do you even have a cell phone?
No, I do not have one. I don't have one. I don't want one. I don't care about them. It's not a big, you know, people act like it's some sort of big moral stance or some sort of stance against technology. You know, first of all, it is entirely a lack of interest. That's really what it is. You know, I'm not interested in having one. I know they exist. I know everyone else has one. I know that my friends are very often angry at me that I don't have one. All kinds of people are angry at me. Like, I can't reach you. And I think, so what? You know, who am I? You know, am I the head of, you know, emergency brain surgery at New York Hospital? Let me assure you, if you have a problem, don't call me. I have no skills. So I can't help you. So why do I have to be available all the time? Why does anyone have to be available all the time? And I see people on their phones all the time. Everyone in the world, as far as I could tell, that I see is on their phone. And I don't know what they're all doing, but whatever it is, I'm not doing it. You know, I truthfully notice, for instance, that I am invariably, no matter where I am in the world, the angriest person in the airport. And that is because I'm the only person who's in the airport. Everyone else is on their phone. So they're not as angry as I am. When is a plane leaving? Why is a plane delayed? Is a plane ever going to leave? Because they're just in another place, which is their phone. Sometimes the fact that people are so in their phones makes me wonder why they're in an airport to begin with.
Yeah, their mind is somewhere else. It's already traveling away.
I mean, so for me, you know, I'm not against them. I don't care if people have them. I just don't want one.
Mm. Is there anyone else like you in your family? Where did it, was
no.
there like a mentor or an inspiration?
No. No, for sure not. I mean, of course, my parents are not alive anymore. But I mean, I looked like my parents, but that was about it. No, there's no one I'm aware of that was like me and my family. Also, you know, I was a child in the 1950s, which was such a different era to be a child in that it's almost like saying I was a child on Saturn. You know, so that, for instance, when my first book came out, a lot of my father's friends said to me, oh, I guess you got your sense of humor from your father. And I thought, Daddy's funny. I didn't know he was funny because he would never have been that way in the house because he was the father, you know. So that my parents were very conventional, and, you know, basically this kind of thing I do now, I used to get punished for because it used to be called talking back. And so, no, I can't think of anyone in my family that I'm like.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and now it's paid dividends, you know, for decades. I mean, you were known for, you know, your social commentary and your critique, and that goes from one era to the next. This year is an election year. I know you know that. How closely are you following the presidential election?
You know, I am following it, but of course, like everyone else, it is also following me. You know, I mean, there's nothing I can say that has not been said before. I mean, and to someone who is a New Yorker, if you had told anyone, not just me, who lived in New York, like, say, before 2015, that anyone in the world would pay this kind of attention to Donald Trump, it would have been ludicrous. Ludicrous. This guy was a joke in New York. Not even a good joke. No one took him seriously at all, not just as a politician, but as even a real estate developer. Everyone knew he was a fraud. It was a joke. So it is literally unimaginable. That we now live in this world.
Are you a fan of President Biden?
Well, yes, compared to Donald Trump, yes. I mean, I can't say that, you know, I was always the biggest fan of Biden. You know, I wasn't. You know, Biden was always, I would say, to the right of me. Also, I did not have to be reminded of the Anita Hill hearings. I remembered them. However, I was really happy when he got the nomination, even though I did not vote for him in the primary, because I knew he could win. I mean, I thought he could win. I didn't know, obviously. And now, I mean, the thing is that people, especially people who are young seem to imagine there's some other choices that they don't actually have. Okay, of course I'm going to vote for Biden. Does he do things I don't like? Absolutely he does. Your other choice, I keep saying to kids, your other choice is Trump. There's not some third choice where the other choice is Abraham Lincoln. Okay, so the same thing happened, you know, during the last election. I mean, the year, I think it was, I can't remember, I think, I guess it was 2016. In 2016, that campaign, I spent that year telling thousands of people all across the country, zero. He has zero chance of winning. Because I believe that. I didn't say it because I didn't believe it. But also, in every single place I was, someone would ask, what do you think of Bernie? And I would say, I don't like Bernie. And I would get booed by my own audience. So I came to realize my audience loved Bernie. I did not love Bernie. I didn't hate Bernie, you know. And I would say, you know what? He's not going to get the nomination. And you have to vote for Hillary Clinton. And people would say, I don't like Hillary Clinton. And I would think, so what? You don't have to like the president. You're never going to meet her. It's the idea that people should like the president, you know, is ridiculous. You only have to like your friends. You don't have to like the president.
They're not coming over for dinner.
That's right. I always say, don't worry. She's not calling you. You know, you're not going to meet her. Don't worry about it. So is there any, I mean, there may be, but are there any Democrats who would not rather have had Hillary Clinton? And if they wouldn't, then they're not Democrats. It's just stupid. Okay? Yes. There are no ideal politicians. So that, yes, there are people, you know, I would have liked Elizabeth Warren to be the president, but I knew she wasn't going to be. You know, so, I mean, it's ridiculous. We have two choices. Life is not a menu. Not every single thing can you say, yes, I'd like that, but please don't, you know, leave out the cilantro. You can't do that when you vote.
What do you say then to say, you know, those younger voters or just people who are just done with, you know, what they call establishment career politicians? They want change. How do you, in your view, get change?
If I was young, or I tell people who are young, you know what? You want to change? Run for something. The reason that all these politicians are so old is because people who are young don't run for things. I don't start out, obviously, if you're 22, you're not going to start out running for president, but run for city council. You know, run for local elections. And they always say, well, I don't like politics. Well, then stop complaining. This kind of idea of the world is ludicrous. If you complain about stuff and you could do anything about it, by which I mean, if you're 22 and you don't like the way politics are, the way you're going to change it is run for something. If you're 22 and you're thinking, I'm not going to vote for Biden because he did this I don't like, I'm telling you that, you know, all the things that would be really, really much, much worse if Trump was a president again will be much worse if you're 22 than if you're 73 like me. Because truthfully, I don't have that long to worry about it, but you do. And this is what astonishes me. The future is the future. The real future only exists for people who are in their 20s or 30s or whatever. I mean, young people. So if they're not going to take care of their own future, what am I supposed to do about it?
If someone is like you, a young aspiring writer, but they're having some trouble finding their voice. Are you a mentor to people who want to write, that are trying to write? Or what advice would you give someone that just is trying to find their voice and write?
Well, if you don't have a voice as a writer, I would suggest that you run for city council. I mean, here's the thing, that not everyone should be a writer. It just, you know, if you want to be a writer, write. And if you're, and you may be good and you may not be good, I can't tell from this distance, you know. But I find it, I mean, for myself. And I also, I'm really surprised the number of people who want to do things they're not good at. You know, basically, I don't enjoy doing things I'm bad at. So, I mean, the only thing I enjoy doing that I'm bad at is singing, and so I only sing in the shower. Okay, but I'm really bad at it. It never occurred to me, you know, friend, you love to sing. You have a horrible voice. Why don't you become a singer? It's ridiculous, you know, so that...
What songs do you sing?
You know, I don't know, whatever is in my mind, but let me assure you, I have a horrible voice, okay? But it doesn't mean I don't enjoy it. Just because you like to do something doesn't mean you're good at it, you know? And if you're really bad at something, there are just certain things. Not everybody has the same abilities. People have different abilities, you know. It's also very interesting to me because when I was young, like when I first went to New York, people my age who wanted to be, other people my age who wanted to be artists, almost no one wanted to be a writer, you know. I mean, it just almost no one. Everyone that I knew who was young and wanted to be an artist, they all wanted to be musicians or filmmakers because that was like the thing in the early 70s. And now all these people want to be writers. It's interesting to me that they do without having been really much of readers. I mean, what made me want to be a writer was reading. You know, so I always say to people, if you want to be a writer, read. Don't go to these writing schools. This is something I find ridiculous. Mm. I know they're all over the country, and they're very expensive, these graduate programs in writing. But you can't teach this. It's like going to tall school. You just can't teach it. It's not something you can teach or something you can learn. You know, I have a lot of friends who are writers who teach in these schools because writers don't make enough money usually to not do that. But I always say, what do you teach them? And they always say, I teach them how to read. And they always say, they should really know how to read before they're in graduate school.
Finally, I mean, you mentioned that, you know, the traveling that you've been doing at these events, I mean, it really kind of took off or picked up again, at least, you know, after the documentary on Netflix and, you know, during the pandemic in 2021, give or take. So that means that there's new people that are getting introduced to you. If someone were to pick up the Fran Lebowitz Reader today, 30 years since it was published, what do you hope they take away?
You know, I never thought about that. You know, I never thought about what do people... You know, I don't think of myself really as that kind of person. In other words, I hope that people enjoy reading me. You know, generally I would say that I hope people agree with me, but they almost never do. You know, sometimes they say they do, and sometimes they agree with me, but I always think no one listens to me, by which I mean people listen to me, but they don't do what I tell them to do. So, you know, I have to say that I've never exactly been asked that question before. I don't really think in that way.
Well, and I like that. Fran, thank you so much for the time. It was nice chatting with you.
Thank you very much.
An Evening with Fran Lebowitz is tomorrow night at 7:30 p.m. at the Mondavi Center at UC Davis. And just a note, the Mondavi Center is a financial supporter of Cap Radio. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Welcome back to Inside on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. He's perhaps best known for his appearances on the improv series Whose Line Is It Anyway, both in the U.S. and the U.K., but comedian and Bay Area local Greg Proops has a much deeper repertoire, whether that's performing stand-up, releasing a new comedy album, to voice acting, running a podcast, and hosting a film club. This weekend, he will be bringing his comedic talents to Sacramento with a performance at the Sophia on Saturday night. Greg joins us now to give us a little taste of what to expect. Good afternoon. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Vicki. Thanks for having me on after Fran Lebowitz, America's foremost wit. I was supposed to be talking to Christian Amanpour, but I've settled for you.
Thank you. Well, I am very grateful for that. Thank you for your presence, Greg. It's a good warm up to this conversation. I had such a fun time going down memory lane, looking at your past appearances. I mean, over the years and years and years, at Whose Line Is It Anyway? And as I just said, you're Bay Area local. When did comedy and improv become your North Star?
Oh, you know, I never had any skills. I would have been a petty criminal. I can't even type. And so as a teenager, I started doing stand-up comedy in high school and then college. I went to the College of San Mateo, or as we called it, Harvard on the Hill. And then I went to San Francisco State, where I majored in getting high. And then I joined an improv group there because they had a volunteer spot. And I sat in the front row one week. And I was reminded of Edward Kienholz, whose parents took him to see a Rembrandt. And Kienholz, the artist, said, I can do that. So I watched them do improv, and I thought, well, I can do that. So the next week I got up, and I jumped up, and I improvised with them. And then I've been doing improv ever since. And I got pretty lucky because I got on the one TV show where we get paid to do improv. Mm.
I took an improv class many, many moons ago. I was terrible at it. That's why I'm a journalist and I'm hosting a news talk show on public radio. You know, what is it about improv that you think you're so skilled at? Because you've been doing it now for over 30 years. I mean, I think you started appearing on Whose Line Is It Anyway in the UK, like in the 80s, late 80s.
1989 was my first year. I was 7 years old, Vicki. I was just a prodigy then. When they put me on, they thought, let's give this young kid a chance. Part of it is, as Fran Lebowitz said, pure laziness. You don't have to learn lines. That's what my friend Colin Mockery always tells me. Also, the spontaneity of it is what I always appreciated. Keith Johnstone was an improv guru. You might have heard of him when you were studying. In any case, he said, it's like riding down a boat on a river backwards, because you only know where you've been, but you don't know where you're going. And I love that feeling of free falling.
And do you still enjoy doing it? I mean, does it ever get old? You know, you've been doing it now for decades. For whose line is it anyway?
Have you met the guys I work with? Yeah, of course I hate them now. And I'm tired of dragging them behind me. When you're as sexually attractive as I am and as intelligent as I am, it's such a burden to work with them. No, I'm in a group with Ryan Stiles. He's the tall one. Joel Murray, who's Bill Murray's brother, and he has nothing to do with Whose Line. And then Jeff Davis. And we were just in Vacaville last week, and we've been on the road together for 20-something years, and we just did another series of Whose Line on the WB, or the CW, rather. I called it the WB because I like to go by the steam-powered network that we started on. And so this is our, oh gosh, eighth or ninth year on the CW, which of course nobody knows because nobody watches the CW, but it's exciting. We're still making the show. And no, I think it's really fun. I've had a lot of worse jobs. So getting up and eating Chinese takeout and then doing a show is really fun.
Yeah. I mean, you're juggling a lot. I mean, you said you were just in Vacaville. Now you're going to be at the Sophia this Saturday in Sacramento. You are solo. What can people expect and look forward to when it comes to your show this weekend?
Well, after the crashing disappointment of figuring out that Wayne Brady's not going to be there at any point, I think I've done stand-up for ages and ages, and I'm from the Bay Area. In fact, I'm from San Carlos, California, the whitest place on the face of the earth, home of the Plain Yogurt Festival. You'll like this one, Vicky. Our San Carlos was so white that our Catholic school was called St. Charles. I'll help with your listeners there. St. Charles means San Carlos. And it's just great fun to do. And stand up on my own. And I've been doing it since Alex Bennett was on the air back in the olden days in San Francisco. And I have hours and hours of material, of course. It's just more than I can remember. But I'll also be improvising on stage, but without the formality of asking the audience what I should do. I will do what they call riffing, as we say in jazz.
Wonderful. Just kind of like our previous guest, Fran Lebowitz. She really enjoys, you know, the spontaneous Q&A. When it comes to your style, did you have someone that you looked up to? I know you mentioned. How would you describe your style of comedy?
I think Robin Williams was the Elvis Presley of San Francisco comedy because he did references and sub-references and arcane references and Shakespeare references, literature references, history. And I've always tried to keep that going. I think he was unpredictable and intelligent. At the same time, he did vaudeville and what we would call below the belt humor. And so I try to combine all those things, that mixture of philosophy and vaudeville, to kind of he, I think, is the lodestar, if you will. I was lucky enough to work with Joan Rivers for a while, and horribly, I figured out after working with Joan for a while that I was more like her than any other comedian. In other words, petty and waspish. And I think she was a genius too, who worked very, very hard, much harder than I do. Joan Rivers listened to every set she did and wrote it down notes after every single set. So I think George Carlin was a hero, Richard Pryor, but I'm from the old days. So the comics I grew up with were Pryor and Carlin, Lily Tomlin, Robin, you know.
Mm. What do you make of comedy today, stand up today? I mean, with technology, with social media, some comedians also complain of, you know, quote unquote wokeness, hindering their work. What do you make of the current era, the current age of comedy?
Well, I think there's a lot of bloody marvelous comedians now. I'm not one of those old men who, thinks everything was better in the old days. It wasn't. Believe me, when I started in the late 70s, early 80s, there were more horrible, sexist, racist, bigoted jokes than you could possibly imagine. And that somehow has abated, and audiences are a little hipper. Having said that, the comedians who complain about audiences being too woke, I feel, are taking refuge. If you can't not make fun of trans people, or you can't not be sexist or homophobic, that's on you. That's not on the audience thinking you're being too edgy for them. That's on you being a horrible, bigoted person. So I find it the last refuge of the scoundrel, quite frankly. When people claim that wokeness is, somehow trammeling their creative flow, I haven't found that. I find that I can be horrible and mean-spirited without being sexist or bigoted at all. So the people that, you know, a lot of them have been complaining lately. And a lot of them, by the way, the ones that complain, have gigantic $50 million Netflix deals and are forcing their bloody comedy on everybody. And everybody reviews it and goes, oh, and then the heads of the networks go, well, we don't want to get in the way of free speech. Well, it's one thing to see free speech, and it's another thing to be a horrible bigot.
Hmm. As I think you're well aware, I mean, you have been in this business for decades, and that takes tenacity. It also takes, you know, some flexibility. And you don't just do stand-up or improv comedy. You also have been an actor and a voice actor. You have a podcast. You have a record label. When looking at your work, I love that you were in The Nightmare Before Christmas. It's one of my favorite movies. I don't think it's easy. It's easy to take for granted, you know, being able to branch out into all of these fields.
Well, gee whiz, Vicky, I got so lucky. And the two or three people that ever took a chance on me in my life that didn't tell me I was too nasal or too effeminate or whatever, they always want to tell you no, as you know. I mean, you're a woman in the show business as well. You understand how horrible people can be. The nice people that take a chance on you, Danny Elfman was one, Henry Selick, who directed A Nightmare Before Christmas, and Danny wrote the score. And I got in the picture in 92, jeepers creepers. I auditioned from San Francisco on a cassette tape. Hello, everybody. And I inscribed my audition on a piece of stone using a chisel. And then he took us on the road about 10 years ago, doing it live with a full orchestra, where we sing the show and play the movie live. So Ken Page is there as Oogie Boogie, Catherine O'Hare. When Catherine couldn't do it, we had Billie Eilish 2 years ago. We had Phoebe Bridgers. Catherine did it this year at the Hollywood Bowl. We've done it in Tokyo, Dublin. So I get to stand next to John Macari, the conductor, and I'm right below him. So he conducts right over my head. And all the instruments are right behind me, the violas. And I almost burst into tears every time we do it, because I'm never going to be in an opera. And yet, Safran was saying she can't sing. I've sung for years, much to whether people wanted it or not. And I sing in this show, and I really love it more than anything else I do. Not that I don't love comedy, but for a chance to sing with a symphony orchestra every Halloween is just sensational.
Greg, it was so much fun chatting with you.
Thank you, Vicky. It was really a pleasure chatting with you.
Greg,
I'm looking forward to coming to Sacramento because I want to have some awesome Mexican food.
We got plenty of that here. Greg Proops is a comedian, improviser, and actor. He is a joy, and he'll be bringing his performance to the Sophia in Sacramento this Saturday. If you're interested, it starts at 7:30 p.m. And that is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. And if you want to reach out to us, our email is insight@capradio.org. Thank you to producer Sarit Lashinsky and managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital producer is Chris Feltz. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. Our show music is produced by Adrian Gilmore. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Have a great weekend. We'll see you Monday.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.